I think it's important that we be very much aware of what the qualifications of elders are. Now, the approach that I've tried to make is a simple approach. With the exception of two or three of the domestic relationships, all of these qualities are required of all of us. Now, it should not then be an unusual or an unexpected thing to find a congregation that has existed for a period of time where there are at least two men who meet these qualifications. Do you think that should be unusual? No, it should not. And therefore, the point being, it shouldn't be a hard thing to find within a local congregation that has existed for a period of time men who are qualified to serve as elders. Now, I've emphasized men who are qualified. If a man desire the office, we saw it, 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 1. And, of course, desire is present. There are some who may be qualified in every respect except this one. And if they are not desiring the office, then they are not qualified. It is a work that is to be desired, and we talked about the implications of this word. By definition, it's used in other passages, the same Greek word, to lust after or to covet after. So it's a qualification that indicates someone has an immense desire to serve the Lord in that capacity and to serve a local church, to be blameless. These are qualities that are required of all of us. The husband of one wife. To answer that, we raise the question, just exactly who is it that God does permit with His approval to have more than one wife? And as we think about that particular quality, it takes us to the next one. Rules well his own house or his household, as Richard pointed out in our study on that point. Vigilant, to be watchful. Numerous passages that teach all of us that qualification. And to be temperate. Again, a number of passages that help us to see that this quality is applicable to everyone. To be sober or to be sober-minded. Commanded of all of us. And of good behavior. None of us have the privilege to behave badly. And we emphasized a number of passages, including 1 Timothy chapter 4, that helps us to see that we're to be an example. And given to hospitality. One who is a lover of hospitality. Again, in particular, the Hebrew letter, the 13th chapter, verse 2, required of all of us. Apt to teach. We noted that this is a relative term in the sense that one might have a greater ability than the other, but the standard is to hold fast the faithful word that one might be able to convict or expose, as it were, the gainsayer. But we see this, the obligation of young Timothy, a gospel preacher. We see this, the responsibility of women. We see this, the responsibility of all of us to be able to teach God's Word. Now, I understand we grow and mature to that level, but it is a responsibility that we are to achieve, to be a good report from them that are without. We've noted that a good name is to be desired. Our influence is important. What people think of you is important in your service in the kingdom of heaven. In our study this morning, we want to revisit something that we started as we started the qualifications of elders, and that is not given to wine. And I've tried to emphasize in our previous studies that these particular passages help us to understand that all of us are not to be given to wine. Now, in lieu of that, it becomes important, I think, for us to consider some things in a little bit more depth than what we did in the Bible class period as we introduced some of these things. And, of course, I have on this chart something that I think is important for us to consider relative to the subject that we're discussing. We're not talking about use of alcohol in medicines. We're talking about the use of alcohol for social or recreational purposes. That's a distinction, I think, that needs to be made. Does everybody see that distinction? We're not talking about taking medicine. We're talking about recreational or social use of alcoholic beverages. And these are some passages that I intend to camp on in our study this morning. First of all, if you'll turn in your Bibles to 2 Corinthians chapter 6, we see that those who are Christians are to live by a higher standard than that which the world lives by. In 2 Corinthians chapter 6, beginning at verse 14, the writer says, "But this I say, he that soweth sparingly shall reap also sparingly." That's 2 Corinthians 9. No wonder that didn't read right. Verse 14. "Be not unequally yoked with unbelievers. For what fellowship hath righteousness and iniquity, or what communion hath light with darkness? And what concord hath Christ with Belial? Or what portion hath a believer with an unbeliever? And what agreement hath the temple of God with idols? For we are a temple of the living God. Even as God said, I will dwell in them and walk in them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Wherefore come ye out from among them, and separate, and be separate, saith the Lord, and touch no unclean thing, and I will receive you. And I will be to you a father, and ye shall be to me sons and daughters, saith the Lord Almighty. Having therefore these promises, beloved, let us cleanse ourselves from all defilement of the flesh and spirit, perfecting holiness in the fear of God. And we're going to notice in the qualifications of elders that one of those qualities is to be holy. But we're also going to notice when we get to that point that that's not just a point that is required of those who seek the office of bishop. All of us are expected to be holy, and to be holy means to separate ourselves or to cleanse ourselves from all defilement of the flesh and spirit. We're to come out from the world and live a different kind of life than that which the world lives. Now there's another passage that I want to introduce now because we're going to camp on it in our study. And that is in 1 Peter chapter 4, verses 1, 2, and 3. 1 Peter chapter 4, verses 1, 2, and 3. I'm reading from the American Standard Translation. We're going to be quoting from another translation as we get a little bit further along on this point. But in 1 Peter chapter 4, if you'll notice beginning at verse 3, I want to begin the reading, let's do so, at verse 1. For as much then as Christ suffered in the flesh, arm ye yourselves also with the same mind, for he that has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin, that ye no longer should live the rest of your time in the flesh to the lust of men, but to the will of God. For the time past may suffice to have wrought the desire of the Gentiles, and to have walked in lasciviousness, lust, wine-bibbings, revelings, carousings, and abominable idolatries. Here's what they used to practice. The writer says, wherein they think it strange that ye run not with them into the same excess of riot, speaking evil of you. Here were some things that these in time past practiced, but they no longer practice. Now in the terms wine bibbings, revelings, and carousings, your translation might use different words to define these things, and we're going to look at those, have a chart prepared, and we're going to look at those in just a minute individually to see what these terms define. And then there's another passage, two more passages that I want to camp on, and that is in Proverbs chapter 20. We've read Proverbs chapter 20, and I want to notice it again beginning at verse 1. Proverbs chapter 20, verse 1. The text tells us, wine is a mocker, strong drink a brawler, and whosoever erreth thereby is not wise. I have a chart prepared, and we're going to look at it in just a moment, but again, I'm introducing these passages as passages that I believe are pertinent to our study that we want to camp on in our study this morning. But when it tells us that wine is a mocker and strong drink a brawler, and whosoever erreth thereby is not wise, it behooves us to understand what strong drink is and was during Bible times. And we're going to talk about that in just a moment. There's another passage, I think, that's important to our study, and that's found in Proverbs chapter 23, beginning at verse 29. Proverbs chapter 23, verse 29. The text says, who hath woe, who hath sorrow, who hath contentions, who hath complaining? Who hath wounds without cause? Who hath redness of eyes? They that tarry long at the wine, they that go to seek out mixed wine. Now what's the answer to that? He says, look not thou upon the red wine, or the wine when it is red, when it sparkleth in the cup, when it goeth down smoothly, at the last it biteth like a serpent, and stingeth like an adder. Now we're going to be talking about these passages as we get into our study. But wine and strong drink, as we saw in Proverbs chapter 20, beginning at verse 1. The term wine does not always or necessarily mean fermented drink in the Bible. There are three words in the Hebrew that are translated with the word wine or new wine. And we might note that in the verses, 134 of them, yayin is translated wine, and it indicates very simply juice of the grape not defined, whether it's fermented or unfermented. Let's turn, if you will, to the Old Testament text of Isaiah chapter 16. Isaiah chapter 16. Now, one of the things that we have emphasized in our previous studies is that context becomes so important in determining the meaning of words. In Isaiah chapter 16 and in verse 10, it says, "And gladness is taken away, and joy out of the fruitful field. And in the vineyards there shall be no singing, neither joyful noise. No treader shall tread out wine in the presses." Now, interestingly enough, the word used here is a word that is not definitive. It doesn't tell us whether it's fermented or unfermented simply in the use of the word. But now, what would the context denote? Was it fermented or unfermented? How you know? All right, it was the wine that had freshly been pressed out of the wine press. So we notice that the context would help us to see that this word is used in this instance to define that which was not fermented. The word in and of itself not being definitive. But if you'll turn further to Isaiah chapter 65, we see another word that's used. In Isaiah chapter 65, the word used 38 times in the Old Testament. Some tell us that the weight of scholarship and contextual usage means nothing more than grapes. And if you look at it at verse 8, it says, "Thus saith Jehovah, as the new wine was found in the cluster, and one saith, destroy it not, for it is a blessing, or rather for a blessing is in it, so will I do for my servants' sake, that I may not destroy them all." Now the word used here is definitive. And it's defined likewise in the context. The new wine in this context and by the definition of this word is used to talk about nothing more than grapes. There's a third word that is used to discuss or to talk about wine, and it's found in Isaiah chapter 28 among many other passages. Isaiah chapter 28, let's turn if you will to verse 7. Isaiah chapter 28, verse 7. And here the text says, "And even these reel with wine and stagger with strong drink. The priest and the prophet reel with strong drink. They are swallowed up of wine. They stagger with strong drink. They err in vision. They stumble in judgment." Now, the word that's used here, how would you define it even by looking at the context? Well-fermented wine. Here is wine that would cause one to stagger. Here is wine that is identified in the text as fermented juice. Now, the three words that are used in the Old Testament text, I believe, are helpful. Here is one that defines not the use of the word. Context must define it. Here is one that, again, indicates contextual usage, and it's as it's used, it identifies grapes. Here is one that is used that identifies strong drink that is condemned clearly in Proverbs chapter 20 and Proverbs chapter 23. So having identified the use of these terms, let's look again at the text of Proverbs 20. Wine is a mocker, strong drink is a brawler, and whosoever is led astray by it is not wise. The American Standard says, "Whosoever erreth thereby is not wise." What does it tell us about strong drink? Strong drink will lead one astray. One who participates in the drinking of strong drink is not wise. Now, I want to ask you, in light of what we've studied just in these passages, would you grant that the participation of strong drink or in drinking strong drink would be sinful? Would you grant me that? All right, so that becomes a given. In Proverbs chapter 23, verses 29 through 32, "Who has woe, who has sorrow? Who hath contentions, who hath complaints, who hath wounds without cause, who has redness of eyes, those who linger long at the wine." Those who go in search of mixed wine do not look on the wine when it is red, when it sparkles in the cup. When it swirls around smoothly, at the last it bites like a serpent and stings like a viper. And we were talking about the argument that if something leads to something else, then perhaps it's a fallacious argument to say that the very thing that leads to something else would be sinful. Look carefully at this passage. What is the writer identifying that is wrong? Look at the text. What's clearly wrong in this passage? Those who linger long at the wine. What's the answer to that? What ultimately does it do? It bites like a serpent. What's the answer to that? Don't drink it. Don't look on it when it sparkles in the cup, when it swirls around smoothly. Where's the place to stop?
At the beginning,
yes.
Out of curiosity, is that saying that they have mixed drinks back then?
Yes. They could go in search of mixed wine. Yes. Okay. There are New Testament passages that we want to spend just a little bit of time with. Galatians chapter 5, verse 21, identifies certain works or lust of the flesh, and among them, envy, murders, drunkenness, revelries, and the like, of which I tell you beforehand, just as I also told you in time past, that those who practice such things shall not or will not inherit the kingdom of God. Now, this little expression, and such like, or and the like, is very important to us. As we turn back to this chart in chapter 23 of the book of Proverbs, the man who looks upon the wine when it is red, when it sparkles in the cup, when it swirls around smoothly, and at the last it bites like a serpent and stings like a viper, is he participating in anything that would resemble any of these things? All right? And such like. That becomes an important term. It's an important term in this passage. It's an important term fitting in this context. And as we look at 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 3, for we have spent enough of our past lifetime in doing the will of the Gentiles, when we walked in lasciviousness or lewdness, lust, drunkenness, revelries, and drinking parties. Now, as I read in the American Standard Translation, we have some different words that are used here, but I think the thing that's important is to identify those words. And we're going to do that. I believe it's the next chart. Now, the beers and wines, or should I say beer, is beer plural or beers? The beer and wine of our day would more nearly qualify as biblical strong drink than wine. Now, why? Why? All right, because of the way they mixed it. Western wine has an alcohol content of 8 to 15%, I'm told in my research of these things. When the ancient fermented wine, it could not have been more than 9%. Now, we use the number 4 to 8%, depending upon the sweetness of the wine, during Bible times. Modern wines are fortified. Does that mean that our modern wines would exceed perhaps 9% alcohol by volume? Well, yes, yes. Now, strong drink in Bible times would ferment anywhere from 4 to 8, this says 9% alcohol by weight. Strong drink. What should be a Christian's attitude towards strong drink, even of Bible times? Stay away from it. What does that say about our fortified wines and even beer? All right, it would meet the qualifications of strong drink of Bible times. Such prohibitions equally condemn drinking similar beverages today. Now, I don't know how many beer or how many drinks of wine it would take to make one's blood alcohol content 0.08%. But I'm assuming that it would be very little. And my reason for that is, I understand you can be arrested if it is found in your car, an open bottle of beer, because that would indicate that you are impaired from driving an automobile. 0.08% blood alcohol level is considered legally impaired. And I might emphasize this, in my research, that was almost in every state in the Union. 0.8%. So that helps us, I think, to understand that law enforcement considers one at least partially intoxicated with 0.8% blood level of alcohol. Now, I want us to look at this chart and spend some time on it because it's important to us. Yes. That is true. I understand. My only point on this is to show that even law enforcement understands that a small amount of alcohol content makes you incapable of driving an automobile, which makes you incapable of meeting the Bible definition of sober. So even law enforcement recognizes that there's a standard by which you cross that you're impaired. Now, the point being, God has drawn the line. If law enforcement says you're not sober to drive an automobile, you're not sober-minded as God has defined it in even the qualifications of elders, much less these other statements that are given to all of us, for example, 1 Peter chapter 5 and in verse 8. Now, in Proverbs chapter 23, verse 29 through 35, we read that just a moment ago. I want to return to it. Proverbs chapter 23, and we're going to drop on down just a little bit in the text. For there he says at verse 33, "Thine eyes shall behold strange things, and thy heart shall utter perverse things. Yea, thou hast or shalt be as he that lieth down in the midst of the sea, or as he that lieth upon the top of a mast. They have stricken me, shalt thou say, and I was not hurt. They have beaten me, and I felt it not. When shall I awake? I shall seek it yet again." Now that's an interesting way to put things. That's Proverbs chapter 23, verse 29 through verse 35. Yes, 29 through 35. And in that context, it identifies someone who is beaten, someone who imagines things, someone who says things, and then when they wake up, they seek it again. Have you ever known someone who had a problem drinking who did not do the same thing? Yes, Peggy?
Verse 35
says, "They have stricken me, shalt thou say, and I was not hurt. They have beaten me, and I felt it not. When I awake, I will seek it yet again." All right.
It says, "They have struck me, but I was not hurt. They have beaten me, but I did not feel it. When shall I awake that I may seek another drink?"
Yeah, well, that's the point. I'll seek it again. No matter what happens to me, I'll go back to it yet again. Now, that tells us a story. That paints for us a very vivid picture. Now, as we think about social drinking, recreational use, or the recreational use of any drug for that matter, we want to look that all stages in the process of drinking are prohibited. Now again, we're not talking about taking medicine. We're talking about the use of alcohol or other drugs for recreational purposes. All right? Does that help us to define what we're talking about? Open your Bible, if you will, to 1 Peter chapter 3, or chapter 4, verse 3. When I talk about such things, I think it's important for us to look at this passage. And eventually we were going to get to this. 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 3. He says, "For the time past may suffice to have wrought the desire of the Gentiles and to have walked in lasciviousness, lust, wine-bibbings, revelings, carousings, and abominable idolatries." Now the terms that are used, I believe, in the King James translation are drunken, revelries, and drinking parties. The New English Bible has drinking parties. Harvey, I think you've been reading some from the New English Bible. Now, these terms are important to us. How are they defined? Drunkenness is an easy one. It means excess of wine, as it's translated in the King James translation. Revelries. again, revelings in the King James translation, the riotous conduct associated with drinking and the forsaking of a social decency. Now, I like to describe that like this. Someone who has drank just enough to be a nuisance, to be rowdy, to be obnoxious. You ever seen someone that drank enough, they weren't falling down drunk. They still had some consciousness about them, but they were loud and boisterous and just simply obnoxious. Now here's the fellow that revelries describes. Now drinking parties comes from another word, and it's translated banquetings in the King James, tippling in the New English Bible, and I particularly like this translation because it refers to a drinking bout or a drinking without reference to amount. Now what would that include? Drinking without reference to amount. Would that include social drinking? Would it include drinking just a little bit for social or recreational purposes? Would it? Drinking without reference to amount. Now, as we look at this passage of Scripture in 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 3, again, now, we're talking about the things that the Gentiles participated in. We're not talking about drinking for medicine. We're talking about drinking for social or recreational purposes. That's what the Gentiles participated in. And in this text, he talks about drunkenness. Anybody opposed to that? Well, we all ought to be opposed to that. Drunkenness is wrong. It's sinful. We ought not to participate in it. But what I want you to see is that all the stages in progression to drunkenness in 1 Peter 4, verse 3, are condemned. We're not talking about just a fellow that's falling down drunk has now committed sin. What about the fellow who has drank enough to be loud, obnoxious, and boisterous? Has he committed sin? Should a Christian participate in that? Should a Christian participate in that? No, not to any degree. Now what about the fellow who drinks just for social or recreational purposes? In other words, he doesn't drink until he's loud and boisterous. He doesn't drink till he's falling down drunk. He just drinks. Well, this verse condemns it. Yes, Chris, and then Peggy. All right.
It's not the end result, it's the step that leads you there.
It's the process, isn't it? It's the process that leads you there. This passage is very important to our study and very important as well to the qualifications of elders. Yes, Peggy?
Well, going through your list there on the bottom, one drink can't have people. So the reveling, or falling down drunk. One drink can do that.
To all right. It can do that.
And you never know when or who for any of that.
Okay. Okay.
So you're better off staying away from it all together.
All right. The process of intoxication destroys soberness. Soberness, we noticed in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, is required of all of us. It's also necessary for obedient holiness. We directed our study a little while ago to the qualification of being holy. In 1 Peter chapter 1, 1 Peter chapter 1 at verse 15, the writer says, "But like as he who called you is holy, be ye yourselves also holy in all manner of living." He says, "Because it is written, ye shall be holy, for I am holy." Now, when someone participates in something that impairs their ability to be sober, are they holy as God is holy?
No.
Yes, David?
No, but another part of that is when you participate in something just because you don't fall down drunk, doesn't mean that you're not influencing somebody else to do the same thing that you're doing.
You mean my influence is at stake? Got a chart on that. We're going to talk about that. Yes, my influence is at stake. But this process of intoxication destroys my ability to maintain soberness, that is, sober-mindedness, sober thinking, which is necessary to watch for sin. In 1 Peter chapter 5 and in verse 8, the writer tells us to be sober, to be watchful, for our adversary, the devil, is as a roaring lion. Now, I don't want to do anything that's going to inhibit my ability to watch for sin. And this process of intoxication destroys self-control. Self-control is essential. It's one of the fruits of the Spirit identified in Galatians chapter 5 at verse 23. And it's one of the very things that we saw in Proverbs chapter 23 that is thwarted, that is thrown out the window when we consider one who participates in the drinking of these kind of beverages for social or recreational purposes. Turn again, if you will, to Proverbs chapter 23. Proverbs chapter 23. Again, reading beginning at verse 33. Thine eyes shall behold strange things. When? When? When you're intoxicated, you see things that aren't there. And thy heart shall utter perverse things. Somebody told me a long time ago that when a fellow came preaching, that he was drunk. When he came cursing, he was sober. But what was seen is a change. Yeah, that's right. It seems reversed, but that's what he did. When he was drunk, his character was dramatically changed. He began to preach when he was drunk. His normal course of life was to curse. But what we see is in this passage, he uttered perverse things all of the time. But his drinking dramatically affected who he was. Look further. Yea, thou shalt be as he that lieth down in the midst of the sea. What's that mean?
He's drunk and
in the gutter, as it were. That's a good way to put it. A friend of mine several years ago used to drink, he said. And one of the things that caused him to stop drinking was he woke up one morning lying in the rain in a gutter where there was water, and he was lying in his own vomit. And he said in that pitiful condition, as it were, he came to himself and realized what he was doing to himself. And he was like one that was lying down in the midst of the sea, and as one that lieth upon the top of the mast. They have stricken me, thou shalt say, I was not hurt. You've heard the expression that when a drunk is in an automobile accident, he's the one that survives because you can't hurt a drunk. And there's much truth to that. Now, none in this audience would argue on the basis of being drunk. You wouldn't argue that drunkenness is all right. But what I want you to see is that this process of intoxication destroys some things that are important to you. It destroys your self-control, as we see illustrated in Proverbs 23. It destroys your ability to maintain holiness, as we read in 2 Corinthians chapter 6. And it damages, David, your influence. Your influence ought to be something that you hold dear. And in 1 Peter chapter 2, reading beginning at verse 11, it says, Beloved, I beseech you as sojourners and pilgrims to abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul, having your behavior seemly among the Gentiles, that wherein they speak against you as evildoers, they may by your good works which they behold glorify God in the day of thy visitation, or the day of visitation. Those who are not Christians need to be able to look at my life and to glorify the God of heaven. If there's anything in my life that's out of place that would harm my influence, then I need to stop the practice of that immediately. Does that make sense to anybody? If it's going to harm my influence, then I need to stop the practice of that. We see that this was a problem with Noah, was it not? This also is something that helps others with soberness and self-control. Colossians chapter 4, verse 2 and verse 5. We can talk about our influence even once we have fallen to try to get back to where we need to be, and how that helps others who may be tempted to do the same thing, to get back where they need to be, to exercise the kind of self-control that is necessary. And of course, in John chapter 2, there are arguments that are made in defense of drinking or even social drinking. And we want to look at some of these. We've discussed John chapter 2. And we've noted that the word oinos is the word that is used here. It can grammatically refer to either fermented or unfermented beverage. But if we take the word to refer to that which is fermented, then look at what we have. Jesus made 120 to 180 gallons of fermented wine. Now, anybody here want to take that position? And to make that for those who are already drunk is inconsistent with the character of Jesus. And there are some other consequences of that. Jesus turned water to wine. If we take the position that when fermented wine is intended in this passage, we have to remember that the wine of Bible times was usually diluted with water before it was drained. And also, the usual alcoholic content of Bible wines varied from 5 to 8, perhaps 9%, depending upon the sweetness of the grapes. Through modern methods of distillation, today's fortified wines are 20% alcohol, that is four times stronger than what the Bible calls strong drink. Beer and whiskey vary in content to up to a 190 proof whiskey, which is, I understand, about 95% alcohol. Now that raises some questions for our consideration. Is it all right just to sip it a little, long as you don't get drunk? Is it? Now, you don't have to think on that real long to understand that what one drinks today, you go down to the liquor store and buy it, it would be considered strong drink by Bible time standard. And what does Bible time standard indicate regarding your relationship to strong drink? You ought not to participate in that. It's forbidden. Now, there's something else that I want us to see as we reiterate these passages. Strong drink is forbidden in both of these passages. I said I was going to camp on these passages, and I believe there are arguments that can be made that are based upon the strength of these passages that really can't be overcome. Now, if somebody knows an exception to it, you can call my hand on it, but I don't know of anything that will cause these passages just to simply go away. And if Jesus turned water into fermented wine, then I want you to look at the consequences. Those in that crowd, let's just presume that they were already drunk. Let's just presume that. If we presume that and then follow that Jesus made for them fermented wine, then Jesus would be approving of drunkenness, would he not? Another thought that we would have to consider is that Jesus made himself a bartender. And further, that Jesus sinned in regard to soberness, drunkenness, and unholy influence. And that this interpretation is not consistent with the very character and conduct of Jesus. Couldn't be so. Just couldn't be so. And then somebody says, well, you know, Timothy was instructed to take wine for his stomach's sake. Why do you suppose that Paul instructed Timothy to do that? John? I don't understand your question.
If, like you were saying, the opportunity for drunk, if this party ever was drunk, it's an opportunity for being drunk. I'm not trying to make a point. I'm asking the question, how could he have been? This is obviously an opportunity to be drunk. It's a drinking party as far as the word is concerned. If that's the correct definition, then in this case, even being there would be sinful.
It begs the question that these were already drunk. I understand the word used there, but the man who is the overseer of the marriage feast said, here's what the usual practice is. Now, whether that was what was exercised there or not is open to question. Here's what the usual practice is. Doesn't demand that that's what they were practicing at that particular occasion. We've got some comments, I think, that need to be made. Maybe they'll have reference to what you've asked, and we'll deal with it. All right. Terry? Okay. All right. Well, again, the point being that if Jesus turned water into fermented wine. Go ahead, Lauren.
Two questions. When you look at the Greek, it only has one word for wine. You go back to what Paul told Timothy.
Oinos.
Vinegar was used and still is used to calm the stomach for some diseases.
All right. Medicine. Could very well be.
A little bit for your belly's sake. People were well filled at that wedding. And if you go back and look how wine was constructed back there, they did have the process of keeping wine pure grape juice for long periods of time. And what they would do when they break it back out, they would mix it with water.
Right. Right.
So it was a sweeter wine.
It was the best wine.
The old stuff that they had, that they mixed with water to make it grape juice.
Yeah. Well, I think the question that John is asking, if I'm understanding him correctly, is the presumption that those at the wedding feast were already drunk. Is that correct?
Everything you've shown, I totally agree with.
Okay. I can't conclude that now. I can't conclude that Jesus went to a party where men were already drunk. The standard was. No, it doesn't say they were already drunk.
He says that you bring out the good wine after people are already drunk.
That's the standard. That's the general recognized standard. It doesn't conclude that that's what they had done.
Well, I think it does because he says, what are you doing? You should be doing this way.
Yeah. Well, I disagree that that concludes that that's what they had practiced. This was the general standard. This is what normally is practiced. But that doesn't conclude that that's what they did. There may have been some deterioration to the wine that they had drank, but to conclude they were already drunk and Jesus then made more, I don't believe is a warranted conclusion. Well, he says this is the general practice. Let me get Lauren and then back to Jenny.
During my period of service, I had a job picking up drunks at night. And I can tell you, the party that Jesus was at, it says they were well filled. And they could tell the difference. You get a person that's had more than two drinks, and I guarantee you they can't tell the difference. What Jesus was doing was making that fresh grape juice compared to that older stuff that they had that they mixed with water. That had a different taste to it.
All right.
According to those who have studied this for years and years and tell me how they made the grape juice back then. So there was a distinct taste difference. These people who were well filled, could tell the difference.
All right. So you're suggesting that frozen concentrate is not as good as fresh.
Well, it wasn't frozen back there. It was buried in the sand.
That's correct. Sometimes boiled down and then water was added to it.
It was very thick and lumpy.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't have blenders back then. So it was when they served that wine, because it was a great quantity of wine they served at that night, great juice, and that was a good thing to have.
Okay.
Because they could keep it all year long, non-fermented.
Right. Right. Jenny, Judy, and David. And then Karen. I didn't see your hand. Sorry about that.
Well, while I agree that John 2 doesn't necessarily indicate that the people were drunk because it said the guests had well drunk, it doesn't necessarily mean that they are entitled.
Yeah.
Being drunk. There's
yeah.
a lot of line there.
Yeah. I understand the point. The definition of the word that I found was drinking without reference to amount, period. So it's a little different point. Drinking without reference to amount. Let's see, I had Judy, David, and Karen, and then Richard. Sorry, Judy. Judy had it first, David. We'll come right back to you. Judy? Bad before the good?
Yes,
or the good before the bad? Okay.
Yeah, meaning that if it's true, if these people, I didn't read it thinking that people were drunk. I,
that they had drank a lot.
Yeah, I knew that they had drunk a lot, but if Jesus was there at that party, in my mind, I'm thinking that it's grape juice.
Okay. It may have been grape juice that had deteriorated some, been watered down some, or to that effect. David? And then Karen.
In 1 John, every man from the beginning says, I'm through the wine, and when the guests have well drunk, that to me does not mean drunk, it means only a lot. But how do you read that?
Same way. Yeah, I don't believe they were drunk. The standard was you serve the worst wine or the best wine and then the worst wine. The worst wine very well may have been that which had begun the fermentation process. In other words, it had maybe some deterioration to it. It may have been that which was watered down grape juice. It very well may have been. Now, those are my thoughts. Now, John, I think it's important just here before we wind things up that it be understood you're not contending for social drinking. You're not contending for drinking in any respect, as I understand what you're saying. Your question has to do with John chapter 2. Okay. All right. We got David, Karen, right quick. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, okay. Well, we're out of time. We'll have to stop with some of that and pick it up another time.